Tell me more about that man that you met out there, Tree Trimmer. Do you know, is he still out there? Is he still living that life?
I have no idea. I suspect he'll be somewhere living that life. It may not be in that particular spot, but I'm... Tree was symbolic to me, almost iconic. He was sort of a skink type character, if you read
the Carl Heisen.
Carl Heisen, yeah, he was like this anti-hero. He doesn't engage in all the political shenanigans of righting these terrible political wrongs. Otherwise, he'd be up in Tallahassee right now. But he is living the life. He's out there. He's close to nature, and he's in a place. You know, that's a very complex river system, and particularly is south of Orlando. You get into flowing wet prairie, and you get into places you don't have a dredged channel. It's very difficult to get to unless you're in an airboat or unless you're in a kayak. You can run aground flat out, you know, without even thinking about it. So having places like that, to me, mean that there is room to have characters like a skink-type character living. Carl Heisen writes that in one of his books, Skink lives in North Key Largo, which is also an undeveloped, virtually undeveloped island, that part of the Key Largo. And certainly he would be able to live any place where you had enough wildness to give him that kind of habitat that he needs. So it speaks to the character, the individuality of the character, but it also speaks to the availability of land like that and the wildness and the subtropical wet nature of it.
We're talking with writer Bill Belville. His latest book is Salvaging the Real Florida, Lost and Found in the State of Dreams. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter or send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Now, you keep a detailed diary of your outdoor adventures. How did you turn that into this collection? Were you intending to do that, or did you finally hit a point where you said, hey, I've got so many of these, this should be a book?
That's a good question. My diary isn't quite as detailed as one might think. I do go out. I have my excursions in the woods, and I'll come back, and I'll sometimes write down the field notes, the things that I see. I'll describe the plants, the trees, the landscape, any animals I run across. I'll make note of that in some way. And I always don't include, I don't always turn that into a story, you know, but I can go back and revisit these notes maybe 6 months later and say, okay, I remember that very well, you know, and let me tell myself the story and maybe other folks will enjoy hearing it in the context of how I tell it.
In your introduction to this book, which is very well written, I think it really gives a sense of what we're about to get into when you get into the meat of the essays themselves. But you talk about great writers, Thoreau, Gary Snyder, Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, all people who have felt strong connections to nature. And I wonder, have those writers influenced your own style?
Well, they have, honestly. And I think anyone who's motivated to write will find some sort of guiding light in that way, some inspirational voice that will help them understand what they're doing as a writer. You know, Bartram helped me a lot, William Bartram, who was in Florida in the 1760s and 1770s. He helped me understand the landscape a lot. Certainly others have helped me with the actual writing process, and I guess I've learned from all of them that to become a better writer, we need to become better observers. We simply don't go into a place and repeat what somebody else has told us. We allow ourselves to open our senses to that place. We slow down enough to absorb the real complexities of wherever we happen to be.
I think it's interesting you mentioned Bartram, someone writing in the late 18th century, being a big influence for you. Why someone who wrote so long ago such a strong influence? Is it because there was more nature then?
Well, that's a good question, and certainly he was here. Bartram spent time in Florida. He traveled throughout the Southeast. He seemed to be most affected and most in all of his experiences in Florida. He writes about his experiences in 1791 in a book called Travels, and also includes a lot of wonderfully drawn pictures of plants and animals that he sees. There's been a recent book by a good friend of mine, Dr. Tom Halleck over at USF, and Tom really provides some crisp perception on why Bartram is still so appealing today. And what he says is, when Bartram was writing and drawing his, rendering his images of animals and plants, he was trying to communicate to folks back in the colonies or people back across the Atlantic Ocean. And by travel time, by transportation time, that would take an awful lot, it would take a bit of time for them to actually receive what he was, committing to paper. So he had to make a point not just to pass along a natural history of a place, a dry natural history, but to pass along something about the spirit, both in his writing and in his illustrations. And he did that very well. And Dr. Halleck says now what's happening is that spirit that Bartram has captured in order to communicate the essence of that plant and animal across an ocean now travels across time. And by doing so, it affects us in ways that we're just beginning to understand.
Bill, you've spent so much time, so much of your life out in the wilds of Florida. What do you describe as the state of nature today in Florida?
Well, that's a good question. I think it depends, Mark, on where you're going in Florida. You can go down in the Keys and have an experience down there that's totally different than an experience you'll have here out on the Mocava River. You can go to the Suwannee and have an experience that will, again, be different from that. I like to think what binds all these pieces together, other than the fact that I have written them, is the fact that I'm not writing about behaviors or the sorts of technology one needs to go into nature, to go outside. This is not about the brand of dive gear. This is not about the technique of paddling. It's not about studying your GPS and talking about the technology. All that stuff is tools. Those things become tools that allow us to go to these places. And if I can read just a bit from the introduction here, I think I try to explain that. These stories here don't include logistics on getting anywhere beyond an oblique reference to place names here and there. There are, thankfully, great guides that will introduce you to the trails and blue ways that will help you identify plants and wildlife, even specific habitats. But to do so in a meaningful way is really up to us personally. If we take this nature exploring business seriously, we learn to trust the most essential guides of all, our own sensibilities. I'm figuring the most any of us can hope for is to have a chance to be surprised and refreshed by the natural world. If you go anywhere outside with an open heart, I believe this chance for discovery is unending. After all, any place is mythic if we really want it to be, and the core geography of the human spirit, where the transcendent rush of the unexpected dwells, is a place unlikely to be found on any map. So that's a description of the essence of how I approach nature, how I approach authentic places, whether it has a tree on it or whether it's influenced by that tree.
So much of Florida, I feel there's interior Florida, there's outer Florida on the coast, and I wonder, that interior spot, so much of it, you get the sense of it being a primordial place. You go down some of the springs and you feel like you could see dinosaurs walking in the background there. But you go out to the coast and it's in some ways a much more flashy, dynamic ecosystem. Do you get a different vibe from inner Florida than outer Florida, if you call that the coast?
Well, I really do. And if there is a wild vibe on the outer part of Florida, it's usually found under the water. Because when you go under the water, you're entering a whole different dimension, and everything, including your position on the food chain, will be rearranged. But yeah, that's very true. When Marjorie Kinnan Rollins, who wrote The Yearling and helped us understand an awful lot about Florida and the stories of the interior of Florida, when she came to Florida in the 1930s, I mean, there were barely 2 million people here, and most of them were living on the coast, 80%. So that the interior of Florida, precisely because Florida is such a wet and soggy state historically, the interior was the last part to be settled. And even now, when we have some of that interior protected in public land, you're going to be able to see what Rollins saw back in the 30s by going into a swamp. You're going to be able to see what Bartram saw back in 1760s and 1770s by going up parts of the St. John's River into Puzzle Lake. Those places haven't changed. The places that are wet and soggy are the least likely to burn. They're the last to be developed because it's easier to go to a sandhill or any dry land area and build on that first, you know, and then, well, we'll get around to the soggy stuff sooner or later. And sometimes, if we're lucky, they don't get around to the soggy stuff, and we still have that opportunity to go out, and we still have that sense of that primeval sense of another place. It's almost another geological epoch, if you will. A time when the trees were dominant and animals were just kind of coming into their own.
For one thing, in Central Florida here, of course, a big source of drinking water people are looking at more and more is the St. John's River, and there's been ongoing debates about whether or not they should allow water bottling plants to take out a certain amount of withdrawals. The local communities putting in their permits requests to the St. John's Water Management District to get more and more water. What are your thoughts on the latest, I guess, developments in terms of managing the St. John's? Do you think are the folks put in the position of protecting that water resource doing a good job?
I'm afraid they're not. No, honestly. I had written a piece for the Christian Science Monitor probably over 20 years ago, and it wasn't my opinion. It simply was a report of a conference on water that was taking place at Rollins College at the time. And some of the leading authorities on water in the state of Florida, including Dr. Gerald Parker, who helped define what the aquifers were about, were at that conference. And they all said if we continue to grow at an unsustainable rate, that is, if we take more water out of the ground than nature is putting back in, then we'll start running out of water. That's what's been happening, because the folks who are charged with managing our water are often at the mercy of politicians who are fueled more often than not by the development industry. That's what Florida has been about. Somewhere we're going to have to cut that addiction, and we're going to have to, you know, have to go to that sustainable growth idea, or we're going to run out of water and we're going to be left with a state that nobody wants to visit or nobody wants to live in.
I want to come back to talk just a little bit more about some of the things in your book. One thing that I thought was really interesting that I learned about you, and you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, your backyard, kind of a little slice of nature that you've created. And in it, you've become kind of a little bit of a collector of nature, Florida species, bringing them in and having them grow there. Is there a contradiction in that between being a lover of nature and bringing nature, I guess, into your backyard little ecosystem?
Well, it probably would be if I clear-cut things and took something that was rare or endangered. That wouldn't be a very good idea. What I've done is basically created a wildlife habitat. The National Wildlife Federation has a wildlife habitat program where folks can do this to their yards. They give you a little sign you can stick up. And what they're looking for is a place where wildlife can come. They can raise their young. They can find a source of food and water. And they can live their little lives there. So while I live near the historic district of Sanford, and there are houses around me, I like to have this little shard, if you will, of nature there. And I do what I can to make it happen. So I have brought back purple iris, the wild iris from the St. John's River. There's plenty of that out there. Nobody's going to miss it. Nature's not going to be distraught if I bring that back, along with some snails and a few of the gambusia. They will reproduce. They grow very well in those environments. And so every springtime now, the river iris will put out the new blooms. The gambusia, the little mosquito fish, their live bearers will put out new fish. There's frogs that, you know, if you build it, they will come. So frogs have kind of just found their way in, burrowed under the fence, have a little pond in the backyard, and they come to the pond, and they reproduce there as well. So there's a lot of plants and animals that will naturally gravitate towards environments like that if you give them the chance. You know, seeds will blow in if you don't have St. Augustine there to choke and cover everything up with this sort of sterile monoculture. Seeds will come in by birds, by wind, and you'll find little trees growing that are native.
Well, Bill, take us out with some thoughts on what the real Florida is from your book, Salvaging the Real Florida, Lost and Found in the State of Dreams.
This is from an essay entitled Fire, Water, Friendship, and the Night. We launch in a shallow Florida cove just before sunset, excited with the possibility of having fire rise from the water. Clumps of turtle grass float at the surface, and black mangroves hug the shore, their characteristic air roots poking up under the bushes like black pencils. My friend Bobby is in a single canoe, and the rest of us are in kayaks. We scuttle about until everybody is ready, and then we paddle out into the Haulover, an old canal that links the Mosquito Lagoon to the north with the Indian River to the south. Long-legged herons and egrets hunt near the black mangroves, each a study in precision. The fire in the water we are hunting is bioluminescence, less of a burn than a dazzle of cold blue-green light. Although this happens in the night seas worldwide, it's more realized in some places than others. Guides will take people to such places, but I usually like to go it alone or with a few good friends. The risk may be a bit greater, but the surprises always seem somehow more real. I paddle out into the deeper canal, and the surface around me becomes suspiciously flat, as if something immense is moving just below. My little boat wobbles gently. Within seconds, the back of a manatee materializes a few feet away, its gray barnacled body like a gigantic sausage. Shaggy snout breaks the water, human-like eyes deeply set, each inside a sunburst of wrinkles. It glances at me, inhales. From inside its massive body, the air resonates as if in a cave.
Beautiful imagery. Bill Belville is a local writer and filmmaker. His latest book is a collection of essays called Salvaging the Real Florida. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome, Mark. Pleasure.